Hi, my name is Ron Manelski from the University of Delaware, and I'd like to thank you for coming out this afternoon, and we'll discuss my work of colloids within wetlands. So I'm studying the impact that contrasting wetland hydrology has on relationships at the colloid scale. And colloids are ideal because it's the active phase. We can see what things are suspended within groundwater, how they're mobilizing, changing residence times, and look at spatial and seasonal changes and patterns. So this was largely a field-based study, looking at role and function, as opposed to doing a mass balance or a lab-specific study. So we selected three freshwater, contrasting freshwater wetlands within northern Delaware, all within proximity to actively farmed land. And we set up a transect within each wetland from inlet to wetland to outlet. And then at each interval, we set up a shallow and a deep well. And we took quarterly samples of ferrous iron, dissolved organic carbon, soluble reactive phosphorus, ammonium nitrate, colloids, EC, pH, all in relation to water table and EH measurements. So there hasn't been a whole lot of work doing this sort of thing, so we did have some concerns with traditional methods, one of which is the use of bentonite in well installation. So we subbed out bentonite for a polyurethane spray. You can get it at Home Depot, and it worked great. We were also worried about stirring up colloids in the surrounding well environment, so we purged and pumped at a very low rate. And then being anaerobic environment, we actively bubbled argon into the samples during collection, and then anytime we did anything with the samples, we would hit the samples with argon again. And then being colloids, we were worried there could be change during transport and storage. So we opted to hook filters up directly to the pumps and filter in the field. So let's take a look at the first wetland. This wetland, again, is in northern Delaware. It's a headwater wetland. It's in the Piedmont. We have several years of water table data at this wetland, and it traditionally goes dry every July. And the key feature to this wetland is that it's seep-fed on a back slope, and that slope gives it that lateral flow. The second wetland is less than a mile from the first wetland. We're still in the Piedmont, but it's a drastically different wetland. This wetland, we can see the water table. You're getting maybe a centimeter or two of movement, and the range is about a 10-centimeter range. So we would call this a steady state or a static wetland, in that as water is leaving through evaporation and then through a nearby tributary and ditch, it's being replaced in kind through multiple toe slope seeps. The third wetland is downstate, entering the coastal plain, so it's much flatter and much more sandy. And this was the most complex of the three wetlands. It's a perch system, so the perch layer is precipitation fed. It has multiple cycles of wetting and drying, and then underneath there's a frangipan that supports the perch system. Underneath that is the apparent water table that's vertically dynamic and groundwater fed. There is a lateral component to that through a sand lens and also through slight differences in soil texture and matrix potential. So let's look at some data. So generally comparing iron and carbon in parts per million on the y-axis for the three wetlands, going in we suspected that the wetland that's inundated year-round and had the benefit of a thick root mass would have the highest carbon. However, it was the perch system that had higher carbon, nearly double, and we think that's for a couple of reasons. One, the perch system is a confined space, so there's not a lot of mixing. And then two, the quality of the carbon. So the carbon source is from tannic acid as opposed to roots. And then looking at iron, we can see that iron followed water table fairly closely in the perch system, which is in blue. And then for the static system, even though we have reducing conditions year-round, We had flux in iron due to changes in temperature, and so the iron was linked to microbial activity. And then, the lateral flow system in green, we can see that we had the lowest concentrations. And so to take a closer look at that lateral system, comparing carbon and iron on the secondary axis in parts per million, the general thought is in these wetlands where you have wetting and drying cycles, that as iron oxidizes, it's strongly positive and binds and complexes to the negative carbon. And then subsequently, as iron is reduced, it releases that anything it's complex to. However, in this lateral system, we can see as water table goes up, we get a spike in our iron 2, and our carbon does not move. And then as the water table goes down, our iron's oxidized, and our carbon actually, it shows the inverse. The carbon actually goes up. Now, there is a dilution effect, so you have to take some of this with a grain of salt as the water table is going down. Moving on to the inundated wetland, I replaced water table with temperature. And we can see that both iron and carbon follow temperature fairly closely. There is some slight differences. So with carbon, we can see at the March sampling periods, carbon is very low. And then we see a spike as plants kick into high gear. We get a spike in carbon. And then we see it starts to dip as you get as microbes work through that supply. In regards to iron, it's a little bit more tricky. We observe in this particular wetland in the surface water very thick iron flocks from iron oxidizing bacteria. So, and then also in the groundwater samples are stained with ferric iron. So at the same time, you have high iron 2 and high iron 3. So in the surface water, we think there's iron oxidizing bacteria. And then in the mineral soil, we think you have iron-reducing bacteria. Whether the two are linked, some groups have worked on that, but this wasn't like a mass balance or a lab study per se, so we don't have any evidence of that. And then moving into the perch system, we can see that both carbon and iron followed the water table quite nicely. And if you're going to make that connection that the two were complexing, this would be the wetland you could possibly say that was happening. However, anytime you take a sample where the water table is above zero, you're taking a surface water sample as opposed to sampling where the water table is below zero, you're taking a pore water sample. So you're not necessarily comparing apples to apples. So I like to switch gears and look at colloids spatially through the wetlands. So this is the lateral flow system. Now each nest of bars here is actual transect going from red inlet to the middle blue and then the outlet in orange. And we can see that this wetland, there's a fairly tight range from inlet to outlet, suggesting low residence times. And then also we know that this wetland goes dry in July, and we can see an uptick in colloids during those periods. And so groundwater is becoming more turbid as the faucet is turned off, so to speak, as that lateral flow is cut off. Moving to the static system, we got a really nice pattern developing. We can see a fairly tight range in colloids from inlet to outlet. And then we see this pattern where colloids increase through the season with temperature. And then the pattern starts over the following year, and we get the same pattern again. So this groundwater in this wetland is becoming more turbid as the season goes on and temperatures increase. And then finally, this is the most complex, and we can see with the colloid data, it's all over the place. So I added some carbon data, and to remind you, this is from deep wells. And so if we look at the inlet and the flat of this wetland, we can see that the carbon is relatively low. We do get one spike in colloids at this April sampling period, and subsequently there's a spike in DOC. So we think that carbon's important in that flat area. But interestingly, when you get to the depression of this wetland, you have no carbon, yet you have very high colloid concentrations. And so the colloids here are inorganic clay colloids. And out of all the sites and wells, this was the only well that had those high inorganic clay colloids. And this is underneath the frangipan, so it's cut off from the carbon source above the frangipan. And then when you get to the outlet, the carbon goes way up again. And so we think that between the wetland and the outlet, there's a break in the frangipan. Carbon's able to leak down into the profile and then is transported laterally to the outlet. So the take home for this wetland is anywhere along the transect and then vertically, there's something different going on. So in summary, we've seen definite relationships and patterns develop based on hydrology. The static wetland seemed to be based on seasonal plant microbial activity. Lateral flow impacted concentrations and residence time. And hydroperiod and high carbon were drivers in the perch system. And then in all three wetlands, we would say that the relationship between carbon and iron was somewhat minimal or muted, and actually inverse in the one wetland. And with that, if we have a couple minutes, I'll take a few questions.